stereotypically been at war, it's been a natural partnership and a powerful one.
The farmers and ranchers, they are taking care of the land. They're growing crops that feed the nation and the world. So it's a good combination. You know, they're looking out for the land, and they want what's best for the land also. Because if there should be a spill or something, that's going to stop them. That's going to stop their livelihood. It'll ruin the water, the Ogallala Aquifer, and that's our life, the water. So we're all concerned about it, and this is a fight that we're all working together on. And I was just talking to one of them. He said, Brian, they did eminent domain. They took my land away. And I, well, they took our land away, too.
Tribal nations from across the U.S. and Canada came to D.C. for a week of reject and protect actions, which included demonstrations outside the White House, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the private home of Secretary of State John Kerry. For many of them, like Eagle Clan member Corrine Roy from the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota, it was their first time visiting the nation's capital.
We're here in solidarity with our Sioux relatives, our Plains Indian relatives, you know, trying to help them get the word out on this evil, evil thing, the black oil snake that's coming through their land.
Roy, whose Ojibwe name is Dancing Star Woman, says she's seen firsthand how fossil fuel projects can make life worse for Native people.
We already have seven pipelines going through northern Minnesota, and this is all going through tribal land, and then they want to put four more, and they want to expand more, and it's just completely ridiculous, because not only is it killing the land, but it's killing our way of life, because I've got uncles back home, and they feed their children and their grandchildren with the rice that they collect each year. And if a pipeline leaks, which statistically it's gonna kill that.
The self-identified cowboys in the Cowboy and Indian Alliance also expressed concern that the pipeline would permanently damage their livelihoods. Mike Blocker from Antelope County, Nebraska, raises horses and grows corn and beans on a piece of land that has been in his family for more than 60 years.
We live there so that we could enjoy the good life that Nebraska offers, peace and quiet, nobody bothers you. Then this happened, and when you think of the chances that when you have this little spot of land and this pipeline from a big foreign company is allowed to come in and tear it up and risk an environmental catastrophe at the governor's approval, it was just too much to sit back and let it happen.
Statements by the Obama administration earlier this year suggested that a decision on Keystone XL would come out this spring. But that was before a court sided with Blocker and other landowners in Nebraska and struck down as unconstitutional the pipeline route approved by the governor. The governor appealed that ruling to the Nebraska Supreme Court, and the Obama administration announced this month that a federal decision on the pipeline would need to wait until those judges have their say later this year. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The Nebraska court case mentioned in that April 28th report is still pending. Indigenous communities across the Americas often oppose mining on or near their land. Access to clean water is a central issue behind such resistance. In Ecuador, a new water law passed in June prompted a coalition of indigenous and civil society organizations to march from the provinces to the capital. Sofia Harin filed this report from Quito on July 2nd.
After 10 days of marching for approximately 280 miles, representatives of indigenous and civil society organizations reached Quito Tuesday to protest a water law recently passed by Congress. The marchers say the law makes it easier for large industries such as agribusiness or mining companies to have priority access to water sources to the detriment of small farmers. Yvonne Yanes is the director of Acción Ecológica, an environmental NGO.
From the point of view of the indigenous peoples, this will go against the traditional and ancestral management of water that has been here in Ecuador since several centuries ago. Of course, you can read the law and perhaps you can find some articles that are good, but in general, this is not the proposal of law that the indigenous sectors presented to the assembly. They think that this law will allow this completely privatization of the water in Ecuador.
Meanwhile, in statements made via his Twitter account, President Rafael Correa denied the law will privatize Ecuador's water and alleged organizations behind the water march are working for an opposition party. Correa is currently serving his third term as president. Initial support from leftist groups and indigenous communities has faded over the years as the president-backed policies which favor oil and mining extraction, restrictions on the media, and a new penal code that human rights groups say criminalizes the right to protest. Presidente! Carlos Perez, head of Ecuadorunari, one of the largest indigenous organizations in Ecuador, said the government tried to boycott the march by setting up police roadblocks along the way.
Solo el hecho de que llegábamos acá a Quito ya es una victoria.
The fact that we made it to Quito is in itself a victory because the government's order was to put a stop to this with police on the highways. But here we are here, despite the police. This march is unstoppable and we will stay here for as long as we are needed.
Hasta cuando sea necesario. ¡Viva la resistencia!
¡Viva!
¡Viva la caminata!
¡Viva!
Perez then inaugurated the People's Assembly, a coalition of 16 national organizations that plans to develop a unified strategy on key policy points before returning to their provinces. Among the items on the agenda is their opposition to a constitutional amendment that would allow Correa to run again for president indefinitely, much like Chavez did in Venezuela. They are also calling for the release of imprisoned campesino leaders and a review of Presidential Decree 16, a law that makes it easier for the administration to shut down non-governmental organizations. Sofia Jarrín, FSRN, Quito.
You are listening to 2014 in the Indigenous Americas, a special Thanksgiving Day edition of FSRN. You can download this and other programs at our website, fsrn.org. Please stay with us. In Canada, members of the Grassy Narrows First Nation are still fighting for compensation and remediation 50 years after massive amounts of mercury were dumped in their water supply. The poisoning has affected the health of generations, and they say the government has ignored their needs. In July, a delegation from the Grassy Narrows First Nation traveled more than 20 hours by car from their community in northern Ontario to Toronto to demand official action. Aaron Hudson filed this report.
More than 50 years ago, a paper mill dumped 20,000 pounds of mercury into the river system surrounding the homelands of Canada's Grassy Narrows First Nation. Ever since, the people downstream have suffered the effects of mercury poisoning, including tremors and loss of muscular and sensory control. Grassy's former chief, Steve Fobister, is in constant pain due to his exposure to mercury.
You lose your coordination, your speech, and your body breaks down one piece at a time.
The details of how more than 2,000 were poisoned were kept quiet as part of a 1985 out-of-court settlement between Grassy and the Ontario and Canadian governments. The settlement established an independent Mercury Disability Board to provide adequate health care and dispense compensation. According to a report commissioned by the board in 2009, the care and compensation being provided isn't enough. The report admonishes the Canadian and Ontario governments for their conscious inaction, high burden of proof for affected residents seeking compensation, and for those who do receive compensation, the comparatively small amount awarded. The report was quietly released in 2010. So quietly, many Grassy residents, many of whom are living with disabilities caused by the mercury, didn't even know it existed until this spring, including current chief Roger Fobister.
Being a new chief and being the head of the Grassy Narrows government, I take the matter of mercury pollution seriously. So when that report was mentioned, and you know, we decided that well, let's take this report and talk about it with the government of Ontario.
The board's chairperson told media that a briefing on the report was given to Grassy's board representatives and a community meeting was held. The Ontario Minister of Aboriginal Affairs says he intends to launch an investigation of the board. Grassy residents want the Ontario government to accept responsibility, to provide adequate compensation, and to ensure quality health care for those affected. They also want the polluted river system cleaned up and are calling for a moratorium on clear-cut logging on their territory. Aaron Hudson, FSRN, Toronto.
Agribusiness interests in Brazil are facing off against indigenous groups calling for official recognition of territorial claims. During the opening ceremony of this year's World Cup, a Guarani Indian youth held up a small banner saying in Portuguese, "Demarcation now," in reference to land recognition. Over 400 indigenous groups in Brazil are waiting for official recognition of their ancestral land claims, but Brazil's powerful agricultural lobby is pushing for legislative measures to make sure it never happens. Lucia Duncan reported on the situation in July.
Terra Indígena Jaraguá in São Paulo is the world's smallest indigenous reservation, the size of just two soccer fields. Its Guarani residents quickly outgrew the space. They now occupy another plot nearby. A young man plays the violin inside of the Opin, a mud and thatched roof building that is the spiritual gathering space for the community. Chief Karai Miring explains the meaning of symbols on the altar.
This represents land. This is all of our spirit, Amba, that illuminates our struggle and all the knowledge of our ancestors.
Starting in 1934, Brazilian authorities established small reservations like Jaraguá with the expectation that Indians would assimilate into Brazilian society. But in 1988, after the end of the dictatorship, Brazil's new constitution recognized indigenous people as the original inhabitants of the country, with a right to enough land to continue their culture and way of life. Daniel Pieri is an anthropologist who works for a Guarani advocacy group.
They are losing cultivation techniques, ways of growing corn and cassava that are unique and super important to their culture are being lost. This causes problems like child malnutrition and other health problems. All this results from the lack of land.
Last year, the government's Agency for Indigenous Affairs approved expanding the Jaraguá territory. But Brazil's Attorney General hasn't signed off on it. So the Guarani living in the disputed area have been given an eviction notice. The Chief Miring says this put the community into a type of legal limbo.
We're a people without life and we feel it. Our kids don't have a future. We're at the end of a process and we're really worried.
No new indigenous territories have been recognized under President Dilma Rousseff's administration. And Brazil's powerful agricultural lobby wants to pass a constitutional amendment to transfer authority over land demarcation from the Agency of Indian Affairs to Congress. Pieri, the anthropologist, compares this to a fox guarding a hen house.
Brazil's Congress is dominated by large landowners. And so there is conflict of interest. Those who are opposed to increasing indigenous land want to be responsible for regulating it.
Last year, the Brazilian Congress decided to consider the landowner's amendment, and there have been public hearings throughout Brazil. Congressman Luiz Carlos Hines is president of the Congressional Agribusiness Caucus. He spoke to small property owners at an outdoor hearing in his home state in the south of Brazil, stoking fears that their land will be subject to expropriation. His language was so discriminatory that a video of the event posted on YouTube went viral.
Descendants of runaway slaves, Indians, gays, lesbians, everything that's worthless, they are allied and they control the government.
Hines has also encouraged small landowners to arm themselves. A Global Witness report says the numbers of environmental and land rights activists murdered in Brazil tripled from 2002 to 2012. But Pieri says the threat of violence hasn't deterred the Guarani.
They are now making themselves visible to broader society. After spending a long time opting to hide, leaving the woods that were left, avoiding contact, they are now doing the opposite.
The Guarani of Jaraguá have joined with other indigenous groups throughout the country to protest and organize against both the constitutional amendment and other laws that would open up their lands to development and mining activities. Chief Miring reflected on the current struggle.
We thought a lot in the beginning. How to create a movement, how can we join together, do and express ourselves, because all of us indigenous people in Brazil have the same fight to win our land. We want the Brazilian government to recognize us as indigenous people with a different culture. We want respect and recognition.
Lucia Duncan, FSRN, São Paulo, Brazil.
The Mayan-led Zapatista uprising continues to be one of the most important indigenous movements in the Americas. The rebel army, known by its Spanish acronym as the EZLN, went public on New Year's Day of 1994 and has built up an autonomous system of traditional indigenous governance in its civilian-based communities ever since. But the civilian Zapatista communities have experienced a series of attacks over the years, including one in the Lacandon jungle town of La Realidad, which killed a well-respected leader and teacher known by his alias Galeano. Shortly after the murder, nearly 4,000 people traveled to La Realidad to pay their respects. During the event, the EZLN's iconic spokesperson, Subcomandante Marcos, made his first public appearance in 5 years, only to announce his final act. Tim Russo brings us this report from La Realidad, Chiapas.
Compañeros y compañeras, hermanos y hermanas.
Thousands of masked Mayan Zapatistas and hundreds of Mexican and international supporters gathered in the village of La Realidad on May 24th to condemn the brutal murder of José Luis Solís López, known by his nom de guerra as Galeano. The Zapatistas say the homicide was part of a premeditated paramilitary attack by members of the COAC-H, an organization of small farmers with ties to Mexico's ruling party. The May 2nd attack was the latest in a series of similar acts of violence by the COAC-H since late January. Zapatista spokesperson Subcomandante Insurgente Moises described it as part of an ongoing government strategy to pit indigenous farmers who accept government aid against Zapatista civilian communities.
Los malos gobiernos piensan y quieren que nos matemos entre indígenas.
The bad governments want us indigenous people to kill each other. They want us to lose our heads, to be crazier and more murderous than they are, so that they can tell the media they bought us off and that it's a community-level problem.
The Fray Bartolomé Human Rights Center found that 15 unarmed Zapatistas